Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
Deviant Women is Lip Media's newest show, dissecting what femininity means in culture, how it's used to repress and restrict, how it's devalued and shamed, but also how it's celebrated.
Every fortnight, Alicia and Lauren discuss a different deviant woman from history, fiction, mythology, and the contemporary world. Those who aren't afraid to break the rules, to subvert the system, to explore, to seek, and to challenge the status quo.
Please enjoy this episode of Deviant Women on Marsha P. Johnson, a legend of Christopher Street, a revolutionary trans and LGBTQ plus activist, and a leading figure of Stonewall. And listen to Deviant Women wherever you listen to us.
Deviant Women. Deviant Women. Deviant Women.
And welcome to Deviant Women,
the podcast where we talk about deviant women from history, mythology, literature, and contemporaneity.
I'm Lauren.
And I'm Alicia.
And welcome back to the show.
Hey.
How are you going?
Oh, yeah. I'm running out of time.
That sounded ominous, didn't it?
Sounds like you're going to die. Out of time.
No. You're going to die.
No, you're not.
Don't say that.
No, you're not. No one jinx me like that, please. No, I am running out of time in terms of the fact that I'm off overseas soon.
You're going to China and Japan?
Correct. In the other order, though, Japan and China, if you want to be technical about it.
Sorry. My apologies.
Yeah, you should be sorry. Yes, off to Japan and China very soon, couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So much to do between now and then. I don't have a clue how I'm going to do it all. But it also means that we might be down an episode in my absence.
That's bad news.
It's bad news. But, you know, we'll keep bringing you the episodes. It won't be too much of a break.
Yeah. Maybe I can try something experimental in your absence.
What the hell does that even mean?
I don't know. The possibilities are endless.
Do I want to let you do that?
I do have holiday. Well, they're not really holidays, but I have 2 extra days off for 2 weeks.
Okay. I'm slightly scared about what this might mean. But, hey, give it a go. See what happens.
Now that I've put it out there, I probably won't do it, but you never know.
So that's what's coming up in the near future for Deviant Women. But what's coming up in the immediate right now future for Deviant Women?
Well, in the right now, I think that we should say happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride, everybody.
It's, where are we now in the month? We're coming to the end of the month, aren't we?
Yeah, June 24. Oh, that's the date that we're recording. This will be coming out on June 27 or 8.
Well, that is a very, very portentous date.
It is a portentous date. And it actually
portentous is maybe not the word that we want.
Precipitous?
Precipitous? I don't know.
Significant.
Significant.
Yes.
Yes.
It is a very significant date. I'm sure you are all woke enough to know that it is the 50th anniversary of Stonewall.
It is. I think last time we were having this conversation, I was like, it's the 100th. And I was like, no, wait.
Not the 100th.
Wait. We would be a lot further along in the world.
Look, there has been far more progress than I think anyone 50 years ago expected there to be. But not 100 years worth of progress. We're not quite there.
That's a little ambitious. Yeah.
So
how are we going to be celebrating this pride? Where are you going to be? Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of obvious where you're going to be.
Well, we're going to be in New York on Christopher Street outside the Stonewall Inn. For a little bit of our story, actually. Yeah. Most of our story is going to take place before and after this event. Mm-hmm. But in today's episode, I really wanted to honour the life of one of Stonewall's most important activists, the fabulous, fabulous Marsha P. Johnson. And I'll also be telling a lot of Sylvia Rivera's story as well, because she is also very closely tied with Martha P. Johnson.
Yeah, because, I mean, you sort of came around to Marsha through some of those other figures in
That's right, didn't you? I was originally looking at Stormé de Lavery.
She's part of this story.
She's also going to appear in the story. I was doing research into her, and look, that's not to say that Marsha
won't come up again some other time.
Yeah. We will dive into the life of Stormé at some point. But when I read Marsha's story, I was just like, oh, no, wait, this is the one. This is the one, particularly on this anniversary, I think, this 50th anniversary, considering, as we kind of briefly mentioned before, the progress that has been made in, I will say, the Western world. Obviously, Stonewall happened in the US and kickstarted the Pride movement in the US, which then spread through North America, Europe, Australia. And so we are talking really about Pride in a Western context here, because I think we can all acknowledge that there is a lot of discrimination and quite awful discrimination that occurs still in many parts of the world. However, Marsha and Sylvia, they are trans activists of colour, women of colour, and these are figures who are not only have been kind of historically overlooked in the importance of Stonewall and the activism that grew out of Stonewall as being minorities within a minority, but as minorities within a minority, trans women of colour remain still the most persecuted,
marginalized
group within the LGBTQI movement. And I think it's really important to tell these stories, because so many of the strides that have been made for gay men and for lesbians don't necessarily translate into their trans brothers and sisters.
Because I think that's a really interesting part of that conversation, because as you mentioned, again, we've been in the US quite a lot recently.
We have, don't worry, with activists a lot in the US.
Don't worry, everyone. We'll get to the rest of the world. We'll move out of the US again soon. But of course, in terms of gay and lesbian rights, I mean, there were already organisations working towards gay and lesbian rights long before Stonewall occurred. Like, even back in the late 19th century, there were still already organisations working towards that. But I think, as you said, the real difference here is that presence of trans folk. Yep. That's where Stonewall really sets itself apart in that Western context.
And it also sets itself apart for being quite actively progressive and revolutionary, because we use the term Stonewall riots for the movement, but really revolution is probably a better term, because it was a complete change in the way that, I guess, from a political context, the way that people engaged with LGBTQI rights and the development of those rights. I mean, for context, right?
Oh, yes. For those who have no idea what we're talking about as such.
I mean, because it's easy to, especially people of our generation, to not realise how different things were 50 years ago. And again, this story is concentrated on the US, but many of these facts are applicable across the Western world. So in the US in the late 60s, homosexuality was illegal in every state but Illinois. Laws did not protect the rights of LGBTQI people who were vulnerable to losing their jobs, losing their housing or their families should they either come out or be outed. Mm. So post-World War II, gay men and lesbians were forced out of the military, where they had been allowed before because they needed numbers, I suppose, and then also out of civil agencies. So when Eisenhower became president, he signed Executive Order 10450,
I love that. Just do they? So many numbers. Do you reckon they come up with these numbers on the spot, or do you reckon
or there has actually been 10,450 executive?
That's orders? What I'm wondering. Like, is this actually chronological, or are people just making up numbers as they go?
I don't know.
I'm sure it has to be chronological, right?
That's a lot of executive orders.
It's a lot of executive
if
orders.
You've got that many executive orders.
Starting from when?
I would argue that you don't have a democratic society. That maybe you actually have a low key like dictator.
I would say so.
If they're getting away with 10,000 executive orders,
that's a fucking lot.
Anyway. I don't know. We're not from the US. We apologize for our ignorance. So this executive order added sexual perversion as grounds for dismissal from government departments. Police and military records were shared with private employers, so many people lost their jobs. It's so fucked. Mm. Like, it's like a purposeful weeding out.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you are undesirable and we want you gone.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, homosexuality was linked with all kinds of moral deviance because, of course,
I love the way you said that so excitedly. You're like, all kinds of moral deviance.
What you think about the 50s, I think this is like, 50s are just like so clean cut, aren't they?
And because what does that even fucking mean, sexual perversion?
Well,
right?
I think like, it's so broad that, yeah, you can totally put a whole bunch of different things under that category.
That could be a fucking foot fetish for all you fucking know. Like, I could fire you for having a foot fetish. Like, I think come on, people.
Yeah, it's probably designed to discriminate against anybody who is not in like a nuclear family with missionary.
Yep.
Yep. Sex.
Yeah.
That's all that's allowed.
Yeah. And just have that missionary sex. Have a sheet between you.
Yeah.
With a hole cut in it.
Yes.
That's it.
Ideally.
Ideally. Because that's how I have sex. That's how you have? Isn't that how you have sex?
Maybe we'll talk about this later.
Oh.
I've got some books.
Am I doing it wrong? Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Okay. All right. Cool. Anyway.
Because the other thing about the 50s, what do you think about when you think about the 50s? Come on.
Beatniks?
Politically. Conservative politics.
What do you want the answer to be?
Think about McCarthyism.
I had a feeling.
That is the correct answer.
Yeah, McCarthyism. That's what I thought you were going to say, but I just wasn't sure. Just didn't want to get it wrong.
Yeah, dreaded communism. Mm.
Oh, yeah. Communism bad. Oh, yeah. Gay people are such communists.
Exactly. Yes. Well, that was the logic.
That's such
it's like,
the logic.
Oh, gay people must be communists.
Clearly.
Yeah. Because we don't like either of them. Mm. So basically, yeah, it was a terrible, terrible time. Queer people faced prison sentences for consensual sex up to 20 years, and they could be detained in asylums.
20 years.
Or life in some states.
Holy fuck.
Life in prison for
Your
consensual
whole
sex.
Life.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, move on quick.
Yeah,
move
I told on you. Quick. I told you it gets dark.
I'm getting bogged down already.
It's going to get darker just for a moment.
Yeah.
Don't worry, we'll bring some lightness back in.
Okay, I'll need that. I'm going to need that.
This is going to be another episode where we both cry.
Oh, fuck.
It's going to be
I'm just getting sick of these episodes.
Hat trick. Three episodes in a row where we make ourselves cry.
No more crying
We got to do someone really light and fun
next
time.
Oh, yeah, we will. Definitely. Next one's just going to be something ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay. They could also be detained in asylums, and in 7 states they could be castrated. Oh. In California's Atascadero State Hospital, they could be lobotomized.
Lobotomized.
Given shock therapy and castrated.
Holy
Yeah.
This is all pause. No, let's not pause.
No.
No, let's pause. Oh, fuck. That's outrageous. That is outrageous.
And this is what I mean where we have to really stop and think about how far things have come. Like, they're not perfect, but...
But, yeah, well, thank God that that's not – well, thank God that's not taking place in certain places.
I was just going to say in the Western world.
That's right, because that's not to say that the exact same thing doesn't still occur.
They are still happening in places in this world right now. That's right. Yeah, they are. They sure are.
Yeah. Sorry, everyone. Maybe, you know.
We're going to get to Marsha's life really soon.
Okay.
Just as a final thing, because, as I said, we are situated really in New York for this episode. So some New York context. In New York City, a criminal statute allowed priests?
I feel like you didn't mean to say priests.
I didn't mean to say priests.
No.
No.
Police.
Okay. Yeah. Police. The New York City police were allowed to arrest anyone wearing less than 3 gender appropriate items of clothing.
Wait, so does that mean you can wear like something really flamboyant, but as long as you're wearing like a watch and a tie and a top hat at the same time?
You can wear a ball gown,
but have 3
slacks and men's shoes,
yeah,
and a hat.
Surely that's still within those bounds, isn't
it? I would think so. So that's where we'll leave some historical context for now. And I think it is important, like I said, to keep that in mind, to remember how important the work that not just people like Marsha and Sylvia and Stormé did, but all of those activists who were involved post-Stonewall. So now shall we talk about Marsha?
Yes. Yes, we shall.
So Marsha was born Malcolm Michaels Jr. in Elizabeth, New Jersey in 1945.
I'm nodding like I know where Elizabeth, New Jersey
is. Well, it's actually not far. It's over the Hudson River.
Oh, yeah.
And the Hudson River played a very important role in Marsha's life. She grew up in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and she remained a devout Christian her whole life. And this is important because she converted to Catholicism later, but I won't dwell on this for now. So she wore dresses from a very...
I'm interested to see where that goes, though.
Oh, yeah, okay, don't worry, we'll be getting there. She dressed in dresses from a very young age. Just from age five, she started dressing in dresses. However, the boys in the neighbourhood made things difficult.
Yeah, I feel like this isn't going to go down well.
A five-year-old wearing dresses, not in the sense of getting bashed, although that probably happened, but in the sense that they, in her words, would try and get fresh with her.
Oh.
And this did include being sexually assaulted by a 13-year-old boy when she was younger.
Not when she was five. Not that it makes it any better.
No. No, but when she was young.
Fuck.
Yeah. And she describes this incident really candidly in the documentary Pay It No Mind, which I really recommend. You can watch it on YouTube. And she says that she didn't realize at the time that boys could even have sex with each other.
Well, I mean, that's youth, but that's also a religious upbringing as well, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's also youth.
And I think general kind of ignorance, perhaps. Her mother also, and again, I think this is really a product of the time. We shouldn't label her mother as being particularly awful because of this comment. However, she did say that being homosexual was lower than being a dog.
Mm. Well, that's difficult as well, isn't it? Because as you said, like her mother would be a product of her time as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think this is how we have to read this.
Yeah.
It's a product of her time. But she got out as soon as she could. So in 1963, right after she finished school, she packed up her bag and with just $15 to her name, she left for the glittering lights of New York City.
Who didn't? Hey, it's a thing to do.
Well, actually,
New York's that away.
If you were a young queer person, New York was the place to go. You know, on the East Coast, on the West Coast, you go to San Francisco.
Yeah.
On the East Coast, you go to New York. Specifically, you go to Greenwich Village.
You do.
Because this was the safest place to be. Because
there were already communities there.
Exactly. Yeah. You're finding your people there.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what she did. So she moved to Greenwich Village, the heart of the gay community in New York. But things weren't rosy. She started waiting tables to make a living, but I think
that's not rosy. Let me just say, waitressing, to all my waitressing friends out there, fuck that sucks. Sorry, that's irrelevant. My beef with waitressing is irrelevant.
Well, she didn't stay a waitress because she got kicked out.
Oh.
And she lived rough. She found herself homeless, a position that would follow her for much of her life, off and on. And she started sex work to make ends meet, something else that would follow her for a great deal of time in her life. But she did find solace, not just in Greenwich Village, but specifically in Christopher Street. Here she met drag queens, and she, I guess this probably tapped into something in her, and she was like, oh, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to join the drag queens. Because I think another thing that we really have to keep in mind is that in the 1960s, the concept of being trans in the way that we understand you know, transgender as an identity and as...
Well, because I suppose at this period in time, I mean, the language that gets used is transvestite, right?
Yeah.
But that suggests much more of an idea of cross-dressing, much more of an idea of presenting yourself as something that you aren't and wearing the clothes of someone else or something else.
And we would not use that word today.
Exactly.
To describe trans people.
Because I think that the whole idea of being transgender has evolved beyond that idea of transvestite.
Absolutely, yep. But at the time in the 1960s, it didn't exist.
Yeah.
And the idea of transgender as that being who you are didn't exist in the same way as it does now. Having said that, though, I think really Marsha is gender nonconforming.
Yeah.
Which is really out there. And when she started performing drag, she really like made a name for herself very, very quickly.
But she identified as a she though, right?
Yeah. She went by female pronouns. Yes. She legally changed her name to Marsha.
Yeah.
Marsha Johnson. She was originally, when she first started doing drag, she went by the name Black Marsha, and then she changed it to Marsha P. Johnson and legally had it changed to Marsha Johnson. And the P, if you don't know, stands for Pay It No Mind, which is what she would say to people when they asked her about her gender identity.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, we shouldn't have the conversation about it because she'd just be like, Pay It No Mind.
Pay It No Mind. That's exactly what she would say. She actually said that to a judge once who was so amused by it that he let her off.
That's good. I like it. That's funny. Probably like not just amused but also so befuddled.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Like, that's funny. I don't know what to do with that. I'm just going to let you off.
Yeah. She said that she never really took drag seriously, like quote unquote seriously, but this is because she didn't have the money to take drag seriously. She.
That's fucking expensive. Oh my God.
Ridiculously expensive.
Yes.
Like she was a drag queen of the streets. Like she found what she could and she made the best of what she could. She was apparently an amazing thrift shopper.
Oh, yeah. That's she's a woman after my own heart.
She knew exactly what to look out for. She knew how to build an outfit that she wanted on the cheap. She altered what she found and made use of whatever she could find that was available. And she would walk around decked in flowers. Like she wore like flower crowns, these huge arrangements on her head.
Yeah, because whenever you look at pictures of her, obviously, when doing this episode, Googled lots of pictures, always like a huge headdress of flowers.
Yeah. She'd also sometimes put like fairy lights in her flower crowns, and she'd be given the flowers from vendors at the flower district, where she'd often would sleep under the table. So she actually kind of developed these relationships with the flower vendors, and they would give her leftovers at the end of the day.
She's
which is nice.
Very ahead of the times. Everyone wearing their flower crowns to their weddings and their bridesmaids parties now.
Well, I know. Hey, they've recently.
Marsha was ahead of you on that.
By 50 years. 55 years she was ahead of everybody with this. Later in her life, she lived with Randy Wicker, her friend, who was another very important figure in kind of the post-Stonewall activism. And he said of her that she'd spend all of her money on flowers. And sometimes, and let's remember that this is somebody who is living in poverty, she would spend literally all of her money. Like she had $10, she spent $10 on flowers.
Because she's living on the streets at this time, right?
Yeah, off and on. Yeah. And she said, though, that they were an investment, that the flowers are going to make her a lot of money.
Mm.
And she was famous for wearing flowing robes, red plastic high heels, bright wigs. She started performing as a member of the group The Hot Peaches.
It's a very evocative name.
Yeah.
I like
Hot
it.
Peaches.
Hot Peaches.
Hot Peaches.
I just keep saying it in that voice over and over again.
Hot Peaches.
Hot Peaches. All right, stop it. It's getting weird.
They were like a drag performance troupe active from 1972 through to the 1990s. So I've skipped ahead in time a little bit post-Stonewall, but we're going to come back because I'm just talking about her drag career generally here. She also later performed with the Coquettes.
Oh, yeah, saw that coming. That's good. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah.
They were a drag troupe from San Francisco and they formed a group on the East Coast.
I love a good pun. Just love a good pun.
There's so many amazing puns in drag names.
Well, that I think that is just, that's entirely drag. It's just all about puns, right?
Because it's so.
The Coquettes. It's so good.
It's camp, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so
camp. You know? So she became one of the first drag queens to perform at Stonewall, which is important to note, was not always very welcoming of drag queens.
All right. So here we go. We keep saying Stonewall, right? But like, let's set up what Stonewall was.
Okay. So the Stonewall was a total dive bar in Greenwich Village, which was run by the Mafia.
Oh, of course it was. Yeah.
The Genovese family. And this is because the New York State liquor authorities penalized and shut down establishments that served alcohol to LGBTQ people.
Right.
Yeah, they weren't even allowed to sell them alcohol.
What?
And queer people were not allowed to dance publicly together. So if you were dancing with another person of the same sex, you could be arrested. It was all under
How the fuck do you police that? All right, sorry, my mind.
Well, we'll get to that, actually. Mm. So this was all under the pretense that it was considered disorderly.
Oh, right. Okay, sure.
Now, this law was overturned in 1966, but the police continued to harass gay establishments because of this whole, like, public affection being illegal between same-sex couples.
And were there still the laws around how many items of gender-appropriate clothing you could wear?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's still plenty of laws that are hedging you in.
They can.
Yeah.
And because of the fact that these restrictions on serving alcohol to gay and lesbian people, the mafia were like, well, here is a market that is not being catered to.
It's an untapped market.
A totally untapped market, and we can make some money.
We can exploit those people.
Yeah. Because it's already illegal. And so they're like, well, if we have an illegal establishment serving illegal alcohol to illegal customers,
what does it matter?
What does it matter? Yeah. Let's just fucking do it. And they're the mafia, so who's really going to stop them? And they had a bunch of bars in Greenwich Village, one of which, of course, was the Stonewall Inn. And they paid off the police, really.
And I mean, that's really the only way you could sustain a place for longer than a night is to pay off the police, right?
And it doesn't mean that they weren't raided, though.
Yeah.
They were raided, but because they'd been paid off, they'd usually get a tip that a raid is coming. Mm-hmm. But it also meant that because they were operating illegally, they were also very unsafe because they didn't have to live up to any requirements of
OH&S.
No OH&S safety standards here. So that meant that they didn't have proper running water quite a lot of the time, behind the bar, in the toilets. They had awful, disgusting toilets, apparently. No fire exits.
My anxiety would get the best of me. I'd be like, we're leaving.
Yeah. We're leaving. They would also water down the drinks as much as they could get away with.
Oh, yeah.
This was a really common complaint among people who were interviewed in the documentary, Pay No Mind.
More so than the lack of fire exits.
The watering down of the drinks was really top concern.
Yeah, right.
So another thing, because they were run by the mafia, is that they would have all of these secrets, right? So because they knew that the police were going to raid them, they would have hidden doors where they would store extra alcohol and extra money, because if the police raided them, they would take all of the bootleg alcohol, the illegal alcohol, they would take all of the money. And so they had little secret compartments where they could hide, and false doors and stuff, so that they could hide alcohol. Then as soon as the police were gone after their raid, they'd just flip the door, back in business.
I love a good secret door.
Yeah. The Stonewall Inn also had really strict door policing rules. So the bouncers would only let you in if you looked a certain way and if they knew who you were. So basically you had to look like a queer person for them to let you in. But it also meant only a certain amount of drag queens were allowed in at a time. And I should also mention that for a long time, the Stonewall Inn only allowed gay men. So that meant no lesbians and no drag queens or trans people.
Yeah, yeah.
So just gay men. But it had lifted this policy by the late 1960s where we're talking about. And people came, of course, because there was nowhere else to go. So they put up with really shitty conditions simply because there was nothing else.
Well, there were other... It wasn't nothing else. There were a few other bars, weren't there?
Well, bars that were also operating illegally.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. But some slightly higher standard bars, yes.
Yeah.
So let's bring ourselves to the morning of June 28. It's early in the morning. I'll paint a picture.
Yeah.
So it's a hot summer night, I imagine. I don't actually know for sure if it was hot, but I'm imagining it because it's June 28.
Yeah.
Now, I did say that normally the police would tip them off when there's going to be a raid.
Yes.
However, on this morning they did not. No, so the raid came as a surprise, which meant that they hadn't hidden their alcohol and their money away in any of those secret compartments. The police entered the club at around 1:30 in the morning. They found all that bootlegged alcohol, some cash, and they began harassing patrons. Now, this harassment, and this is not unusual, this is not exclusive to this one particular raid, but this harassment included having a female officer take gender non-conforming patrons into the bathroom to check their gender.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. Can you imagine the humiliation of that? Like having somebody pull you into the bathroom to check what's in your pants?
Yeah. Yeah. That happens a lot still. That's not I feel like that's not something that stopped.
I mean, if we think about all of the controversy around trans people and bathroom rights, for fuck's sake, why the fuck are people so concerned about what's in people's pants?
Other people's pants.
Yeah. Other people's pants. Not your own pants. Worry about what's in your own pants.
Think about your own pants.
Don't worry about what's in anyone else's pants.
Unless that person is consensually wants you to worry about what's in their pants because they want to share what's in their pants with you and you want to have what's in their pants shared with you.
And
then you can all worry about each other's pants. Otherwise, complete strangers, just leave their pants alone. All skirts.
Yeah, which dresses.
Whatever. Whatever it happens to be.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Pay it no mind.
Pay it no mind. Some people are really obsessed with that, hey?
They're fucking obsessed.
Yeah.
Oy. Which I think says a lot more about them than it does about anyone else.
That's right. You sounded like such a mother then. That is the advice you are going to give your child when they come home crying because someone's bullied them. You're going to be like, that says a lot more about them than it does about you, honey. So good job, Lauren. I like it.
Anyway, so they arrested 13 people, many of whom were arrested under the gender-appropriate clothing statute.
Do they normally arrest people?
Yes.
When they do raids?
Yeah.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah, if they, mm-hmm. if they had to. Yeah. Yeah. But again, like normally they would be tipped off, which meant that they would most stop dancing, get out. They'd get out. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, however, this time, normally after a raid, everybody would sort of disperse and go home, like, fun's over for tonight. Mm. This night, however, they didn't. They didn't disperse. They stayed at the bar outside waiting. And there's a lot of first-person accounts that you can listen to that you can find on YouTube. There's some an excellent podcast called Making Gay History with Eric Marcus that I very highly recommend because he has gone through decades-old tapes of interviews with some of these original LGBTQI activists. And to hear them describe this night in their own words is something that I highly recommend. So please go back, like go and find it because it's definitely out there. Mm. But many people say that they don't really know that there was any one particular thing.
Yeah, there's so many night. Different stories, aren't there?
Yeah.
Like, lots of different versions.
And like why they hung around this particular night and didn't just go home. Sylvia Rivera in one of those interviews with Eric Marcus says they were just kind of sick of it. They were sick of being treated this way and it had just sort of reached that tipping point, I think. So, yes, as you said, there are a couple of different versions of what happened at this point. And this is where
there
the story...
are some really silly ideas around Judy Garland as well, aren't there?
Yeah, because it was also the evening of Judy Garland's funeral.
Yeah.
And, of course, she was a gay icon, hugely kind of influential, not just in the gay movement then, but particularly in the 50s and stuff where you had to be a little bit more underhanded. Like the code, are you a friend of Judy's, was used to kind of figure out if somebody else was gay.
But it seems so reductive though to just be like, oh, everyone's pretty upset about Judy Garland.
Well, this is it. People who were there will dispute. Like, it happened.
Yeah, definitely.
And she meant a lot. She was important in the community.
But it didn't send everybody off into a riot.
That's right. Stonewall did not happen because Judy Garland died.
Yeah, there's so many there are so many weird theories, right? I just think that's one of the weirdest theories.
Yeah, yeah. Which I think it's a fun story, but no, they were pissed off because of the continual harassment and discrimination that they faced.
Yeah.
And one version of the story, which is probably the most accurate, is the police officer removed the drag king, Stormade de Lavery, forcing her into the back of a paddy wagon. And she yelled at the crowd to act.
Mm.
She's like, fucking do something, guys. Like, are you just going to let this happen?
Yeah.
And it's said that she threw the first punch. I don't know that it was necessarily like a physical punch. That's up in the air. That's one of these unknown stories. But many people do say that she is the one who incited the riot with this call to action. Now, according to one story, it was Marsha who incited the riot. However, this one is probably not true, mostly because, as I said, the raid occurred at 1:30 in the morning and Marsha, in her own words, says that she didn't actually arrive at the Stonewall until 2 o'clock in the morning, so half an hour later. However, according to this version of the story, Marsha declared, "I got my civil rights," and threw a shot glass into a mirror, which allegedly started the riots, and it became known as the shot glass that was heard around the world. Yeah. Which is quite a powerful phrase.
Quite often, though, with these kinds of stories, the legend becomes more important or more powerful, but it becomes the story that circulates, right?
Yeah.
That's it. It's the legend that builds up around it.
Yeah.
But then, of course, that means that unpicking the facts from the legend becomes so much harder to do because that's the story that perpetuates itself.
Exactly.
Yeah. But as you said, she said in her own words that she wasn't even there.
She wasn't there just yet. Was there though, like she did
she
arrive.
Came. Yeah, she came.
And once she was there, she was very involved.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So the police were called, obviously. The fire brigade were called. The riot squad was called. They barricaded themselves in and people started throwing rocks and pennies and bottles. And apparently the pennies were actually quite symbolic of like paying off the police.
Right, yeah.
Whatever they could get their hands on, they started throwing basically. And there's a story that Marsha climbed up a lamppost and dropped a brick from her bag onto, like, smashing the window of a police car. We don't know if it was a brick, but she threw something out of her handbag onto a police car. That, I think there are a few witnesses for, so I think that that did happen. Another thing that happened is that there were rocket-style kick lines formed on the street, and so it wasn't even just, like, it wasn't just
your standard barricade.
It was a barricade of drag queens. And other, like, you know, gay men and lesbians. Rocket style kicking, can-can dancing along the street, which I think is amazing. The protest continued for 6 nights, and each night more and more people were coming out. Often they came with like leaflets and flyers and handed them out to the crowd as well. And so that, in a nutshell, is Stonewall. And if you really want to know the in-depth history of Stonewall, you should read Stonewall, The Riots That Sparked the Gay Revolution by David Carter. It's a really in-depth historical account of the riots in general. And obviously I cannot do them entirely justice in this little episode. But that is to say, Marsha was there and she was a leading figure in the riots. And more importantly, really, she was a leading figure in the activism that occurred post-Stonewall. And this is where we see her really, like, come into her role as an activist, as a trans activist. And not just that, but also an activist for street kids, for sex workers, for queer people of colour. Together with Sylvia Rivera, they made a lot of strides. So let's get into that.
So she was already a bit of a character, like somebody that people knew even before Stonewall happened.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Right. Mm-hmm. She was really popular in Greenwich Village. People knew her. They loved her. She was really famous for being very smiley and very joyful and very generous. And her friend Randy Wicker, who I mentioned before, he says that many called her Saint Marsha. And it's this kindness that actually led to her lifelong friendship with her fellow trans activist, Sylvia Rivera. And I want to tell you a little bit about Sylvia's story as well. It parallels Marsha's in so many ways, particularly from this point on, much of the activist work that they did together. Mm-hmm. So Sylvia met Marsha when she was just 12 years old, and Marsha became a mother to her, in Sylvia's words. Sylvia was living on the streets. She was working as a child prostitute.
At 12.
Yeah, actually. So she had a really difficult upbringing. Her father abandoned the family just after she was born. Her mother died when she was just 3. She was raised by her grandmother. And she would, you know, like Marsha, she kind of knew that she was different from a very young age. She would dress in her grandmother's clothes, wear her grandmother's makeup. And when her grandmother caught her, she would, quote, give her a whipping, which I think, again, is kind of standard at the time. And I don't want to make her grandmother out to seem like this awful, again, awful, abusive, you know, transphobic, homophobic woman. It wasn't, I don't think, that malicious. Her grandmother was really worried about her. And I think she was really worried about her because the community started to talk about her. So her grandmother was Venezuelan and she came home one day apparently. And again, you can hear Sylvia recount this story in Eric Marcus's Making Gay History. Her grandmother came home one day and was really upset. And she said that people had been calling Sylvia a F word. I'm not going to say the word. Oh, yeah. And she was so upset. Sylvia didn't, she respected her grandmother so much, she didn't want to make life difficult for her. So she chose to leave. So in 1961, she was 10 years old. She ran away. And this is when she started working as a sex worker. Hmm. Yeah. And, yeah. Again, listen to Sylvia tell her own story in Making Gay History, the podcast. When she was a child, her grandmother had to bail her out of jail again and again. And this is after she'd left home. And Sylvia says she doesn't even know how many times this happened because young gay men were particularly targeted and arrested for what they were doing. And this, though, I think gave her the drive to fight for the rights of the most vulnerable of the LGBTQ community, particularly trans sex workers, street kids, and queer folk of colour. Mm. So that is a huge part of her activism. And she met Marsha in 1963, and this was like a totally transformational encounter. She describes, as I said, Marsha was the mother that she never had, and she gave her that love and acceptance and the stability of a family. And the two were so close for the rest of their lives.
So obviously, right, so they already knew each other obviously before Stonewall happened. They were already inseparable by this point. So obviously it's going to make sense then that they go on to do their work together.
Yeah, definitely. And so Marsha was a founding member of the Gay Liberation Front, which was an organisation that rose in the aftermath of Stonewall. And they were a really kind of counterculture activist group. They were like hardcore lefties. They believed that it was necessary to dismantle social institutions, particularly the nuclear family.
Oh, they were communists. Turns out they were communists. All right.
And they basically, they wanted to redefine sexual roles, redefine gender, redefine a whole bunch of stuff. They were just really anti-establishment.
Mm.
But together with Sylvia, she founded STAR. Well, Sylvia really founded STAR and asked Marsha to come on as vice president. So STAR stands for Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, which today is called Street Transgender Action Revolutionaries. And so this STAR.
I thought you were saying, I'm sorry, maybe this is an inappropriate joke. I thought you were saying Sweet Transvestite.
Do you know how many times I read Sweet Transvestite and in my head I read it as Sweet Transvestite? Do you know how many times I've seen Rocky Horror?
I know, it's very hard not
to. It's probably the film I've seen most times in my life.
Do you really?
Yeah, I've seen it so many times and it's definitely the film I've seen at the cinema the most times.
So
because I go to like so many midnight screenings
of
Rocky Horror.
Well, there are a lot of midnight screenings of Rocky Horror. Yeah.
So
anyway, I'm so
I can't help myself but read Sweet Transvestite. It's Street Transvestite. Yes. Yeah. And now Street Transgender Action Revolutionary.
Somebody should change Rocky Horror to be
Transgender Action Revolutionary
from Christopher Street,
New York.
Doesn't have the same ring to it. Actually, don't change it. Just leave Rocky Horror how it is. Yeah.
So STAR began after a sit-in at Weinstein Hall. Look, sorry about the name.
Awkward.
New York University. And also sit-ins were such a, like, they were all the rage in the late 60s, early 70s, weren't they?
We should bring sit-ins back.
When was the last time we had a good sit-in?
Oh, my God. It's been a long time. Yeah, let's bring back sit-ins.
Something to keep in mind. They worked, and this one worked. So basically the sit-in was because school administrators had cancelled a dance because it was sponsored by a queer organisation. And so they were protesting this, obviously.
Obviously.
Yeah. And a few prominent groups, including the Gay Liberation Front and, get this, the Radical Lesbians, all one word, Radical Lesbians.
Oh, that's good.
They protested with the students and they were successful in overturning the ban.
Hooray! Party times.
And on the last day of the five-day sit-in.
Oh, see, shit. Why do we have sit-ins anymore?
Yeah.
5 days.
Because nobody has 5 days.
I've got 5 days.
Do you?
Look, if
anyone. You were just talking about how busy you are.
I am. Look, I am busy, but I'm never too busy for a sit-in. If anyone out there is interested in a sit-in, I don't know what we're sitting in about, but just get in contact.
All right. We'll find a cause.
Yeah. I got lots of causes, man. I don't know if sitting in will be of help to any of us.
Just bring your computer with you and do some work.
Yes,
I think that defines
sit
the point.
In and do some marking. That's basically what I do anyway. It's basically how I live my life.
That's your life.
Yeah.
Anyway, after the 5-day sit-in, Sylvia began to consider who was being left out. basically. Mm. So after the police forced everyone to disperse, it was the trans kids and the street kids who were the last to leave, and they kind of all gathered on the steps. And she came to realize that the needs of young LGBTQ youth, particularly trans youth of color and street youth, were not being met by existing queer activism groups. There wasn't anything for trans folk and transvestites, and I say that in quote unquote, that's the language of the day, not the language of today, and drag queens were seen as being kind of the bottom of the pile in terms of this community. They were undesirable really because they were seen as giving them a bad name. Mm. Many of the people who belonged in these other activist groups were white, middle class, and a lot of them just wanted to pass in society. They just wanted to get on with their lives, not be seen to be making a fuss, not be seen to be disruptive, not be seen to be, deviant in any way.
See, this, I don't know if this is an appropriate segue or not, but I mean, this makes me think of groups like the Mattachine, isn't it? Who were, around at the same time, who were working pretty much, who didn't like what was going on around Stonewall because the Mattachine were a white, middle class, male organisation that was trying to promote gay rights.
Exactly.
But in that kind of way where it was, look, we're not weirdos, we're not different, we're just like you.
Yeah.
And it was kind of that sense of trying to, I guess, quote unquote, be normal and quote unquote, not be troublesome.
Exactly.
Whereas obviously the work that was coming out of Stonewall was troublesome.
That's right.
It was disruptive.
And this includes like the Gay Liberation Front and the Radical Lesbians. Like they are also pushing the boundaries.
Yeah.
I'm not putting them in the same category as being wanting to pass and not making a fuss because these groups did want to make a fuss.
Yeah, and that's exactly what groups like Mattachine didn't want them to do. They were like, shut up, you're ruining it. You're ruining it.
Exactly.
Because you're being too loud and you're being too flamboyant and you're being too over the top.
Yep.
This comes back to something we were talking about in the last episode as well, that idea that I guess for a certain percentage of society, it's that idea of, look, we're making a space for ourselves and we're going to get it right for us and then we'll come back and pick you up later. Like that's very much that conversation we had in the last episode.
Yep.
And I guess, and I suppose that's exactly what Marsha was fighting against, that idea of...
And Sylvia specifically was fighting
against, right? Was that idea of trying to fit into a particular conservative idea and actually fitting yourself into a box.
And even though these other radical groups did exist, they still were not inclusive of those trans folk and street kids.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. Or people of colour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, totally. And this is what they committed themselves to. So Sylvia, you know, started STAR. She asked Johnson to come along and help her out. And together they took matters into their own hands and they opened the first STAR house, which was actually a trailer that they parked in a Greenwich Village car park. And it was a place where LGBTQ youth could come together, where trans sex workers often came to sleep, and also just to socialise and support one another. So it did offer that, you know, safe space to sleep in, food, etc. But really it was about creating a community. However, perhaps unsurprisingly, it wasn't long before the trailer was towed with 20 people still sleeping inside. So they knew they had to find a more permanent solution. So they opened instead.
I wonder how far they towed it before they... Anyway.
So they opened at 213 Second Avenue. They raised funds by holding a dance together with the Gay Liberation Front. See, they are allies. And they were able to expand their services into education and they offered things like literacy support during the day. However, money was really, really tight. So Marsha and Sylvia basically supported the organization through their sex work.
What?
So in the evening, they were out making the money for the organization and during the day, they were working in the organization providing that support. So they were deeply committed. Like, this is a labor of love.
Yeah.
The good news is that STAR later expanded into other cities in the US. However, it did collapse in the mid-70s, but it has been revived. As I said, it was revived as the Street Transgender Action Revolutionaries, and Sylvia was also involved in revising it as the Street Transgender Action Revolutionaries. It was the first LGBTQ shelter in North America, the first organization led by trans women of color and the first trans sex worker labor organization.
Wow.
So they achieved a lot with STAR, even though it was quite a small organization. Like, it was very grassroots.
Yeah.
Very small. Big achievements, though.
But that's the thing, though. How many of these organizations are grassroots? Like, so many
of
them.
Oh, of course. Yeah. That's how they have to start. Yeah,
exactly.
Because it's not like, oh, what, you're going to apply for federal funding to open?
Yeah.
Like, in 1970?
No, of course not. You have to pour your life and soul into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they continue their activism as well. So they were also involved in getting some of the first Pride parades started. So there was the parade in 1970, and by
1970, that parade was like commemorating Stonewall.
Yeah, right. The first Pride parade was on the anniversary of Stonewall, and it wasn't just in New York. There were Pride parades in other cities across the US. And by 1973, it had grown a bit bigger. But the New York Pride committees banned drag queens from participating in the parades. As we said, they believe they gave them a bad name.
Sorry, I mean lol only because, like, you go to a Pride.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a Pride parade
without a drag queen?
Who's Come going on. To that? No one's going to that. No one is going to that.
Yeah, but they thought they gave them a bad name because, again, they wanted to be taken really seriously. And so Marsha and Sylvia, well, guess what they said?
I'm going to think they said something along the lines of, like, fuck that.
Yeah, fuck that. And they marched at the front for the entire parade. Now, Sylvia forced her way. So once the parade had ended, there was a stage at the end, and Sylvia forced her way onto this stage and gave an incredibly powerful speech, which you can watch in its entirety on YouTube, and you can also see it as a part of the film The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, which is on Netflix. I highly recommend it. This speech will probably make you cry. It's incredibly powerful. She,
by the way, I just went like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm getting used to that.
Yeah. She basically called out cis, white, middle-class gays and lesbians for ignoring the plight of drag queens, trans folk, street kids and minority LGBTQ folk. They felt that the gay rights movement had forgotten and left behind their trans brothers and sisters, and the crowd booed her as she spoke.
Whoa.
Now, again, we need to remember that what Sylvia and Marsha represented was this group that was marginalized within an already marginalized community. And we have talked about this, but Sylvia said that she never wanted to pass. She never wanted to be invisible and like pass as a woman in the world. She wanted to be herself. And that's who she was. She was Sylvia, you know, in much the same way that Marsha was Marsha.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't trying to be anything other than that.
To be honest, in much the same way any of us wants to just be who we are.
Exactly, without having
like,
to.
Like, how many of us want to be recognized first as a gender?
Yes.
And then secondly as the individual that we are?
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty basic human right, right? To be recognized first as an individual.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's just my, that's my two cents. That's my two cents. It seems like, that to me seems like a fairly reasonable request.
Yeah, that does. That's actually like kind of, I don't know. I just had a moment when you said that and I was just like, oh, fuck. Like, fuck. Fucking of course.
It's pretty reasonable.
It's pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
And again, that comes back to why I really wanted to focus on these stories for this episode because trans folk is still not seen as so often, not all the time, I hope, but so often not seen as being individuals.
This is definitely still an issue. Absolutely. Yeah. Of course it is. All of these issues are still issues.
And are still a minority in a minority community.
Mm.
But I want to draw your attention to something that happened just after this in 1975 on a much, much lighter note, much lighter note.
Good. I like a lighter note. Let's go there.
And this is because Marsha caught the eye of a gentleman artist.
Oh, yeah. I know the gentleman artist that you're talking about, don't I?
By the name of?
I'm going to assume you mean Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
And he photographed her for a series called Ladies and Gentlemen, which documented those who subverted gender binaries. Warhol took Polaroids and then he created portraits. He silkscreened the photos onto canvas and he painted swashes of colour in his very Warholian particular style. Is that the word? I don't know.
Warhol-esque.
Made it up. Warhol-esque.
Yeah.
So she
put that in your Warholian and smoke it.
You should have a look at the images that he created, not just of Marsha but of everybody that he did. Like, they're really, again, fun, fabulous. And I really like that he was celebrating gender non-conforming people in 1975, which feels really progressive at that time. So there was a lot of really fun and fabulous things that happened in Marsha's life. She had an excellent drag career. She was beloved. She was a very happy, generous person.
She was helping to change people's lives.
Yes, working with Sylvia on incredibly important projects. However, there was a lot of darkness in her life at the same time. Mm. So part of that is that she was very often arrested. She said that she stopped counting after the 100th time that she was arrested. She was also once shot by a client.
Oh.
And apparently this was one of 8 attempts that were made on her life by clients.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And can we just say on that, right? That's exactly why it's so important to decriminalise sex work.
Absolutely.
In the first place, so that that sort of shit isn't what happens.
So that you can actually work in a safe and regulated environment.
And not get shot at.
Yeah. And actually on that, can we just say that South Australia has just passed legislation to decriminalise sex work, passed the upper house. It's got to go through the lower house still. But we're one step closer and that's really exciting and there's a lot to celebrate. And I also just want to give a shout out to my sister-in-law, Georgia, who works for SIN, which is the Sex Industry Network, and they've been doing some really amazing activist work in getting this legislation passed.
That is excellent. But also, do you reckon that that acronym will like... Do you think they came up with? Do you think they came up with the acronym first, or with the?
I'll ask it.
Do you know what I mean?
I'll ask.
Do you think they said, "Let's just call ourselves SIN, and then we'll make it fit"?
Yeah.
Or was it pure coincidence? Look, you know what? It's not the important thing.
But anyway, so there's hopefully going to be something to celebrate here in Adelaide.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? By the next episode, we'll see.
Yeah.
Maybe not by the next.
Probably not by then.
But sometime soon.
Yay. But yes, that's why it's important to decriminalise sex work so that we can look after sex workers.
Yeah.
Because sex work is work.
Yeah.
So the other kind of darkness that was present in Marsha's life is that she struggled with her mental health for a lot of her life. And she was in and out of institutions and on and off medication quite a lot. She says that her breakdown started in 1970 and she had about 8 of them in total.
Yeah.
And she would be drugged with Thorazine.
I don't know which, if that's a good thing or a bad. I'm going to assume that's a bad thing.
So, yeah, it's an antipsychotic medication and apparently she would come out of these institutions and be taking her prescriptions and she'd be kind of a zombie for like a month and then she'd stop taking it and kind of become herself again. She also had a darker side to her personality that she called Malcolm, which is her
name at birth.
Birth name.
Yeah.
And apparently Malcolm could be quite angry and violent and not very nice, which is completely in contrast to Marsha, who was by all accounts incredibly kind and generous and loving and open. And a lot of this seems to be attached to a lot of kind of religious and spiritual ideas as
right.
well.
Yeah, because you were saying she did remain devoutly.
Yeah.
Or she converted to Catholicism.
She converted to Catholicism and was a Christian throughout her life. And a lot of the things that she said kind of have this religious bent and this kind of spiritual edge to them, which I don't know, I guess for some people maybe that seems like psychosis, whereas maybe for her it's devotion.
Mm.
So for example, David Carter, the author of Stonewall, quotes her as saying, "Sometimes I have visions. In one of them there are 10 suns shining in the sky, gorgeous and freaked out like the end of the world. I love my saints, darling, but sometimes the visions can be scary."
I was going to say, that's a very saint thing.
It is a very saint thing to do.
She's Saint Marsha.
On that as well, she, according to another friend of hers, Bob Kohler, she used to make offerings to her father, Neptune, would strip off her clothes and she would take the clothes of her friends and throw them in the Hudson River. So they would be
with
like...
With consent or without consent?
I think with playful consent.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like mucking around.
Don't throw my clothes in the river, thank you very much.
So they used to go sunbathing at the pier, so they would be undressed, right? They would go sunbathing and she wanted to make appeasements to help her friends on the other side. And so she'd offer up clothing and flowers to the river. I should say another part of her activism that came later in her life was that she became an AIDS activist. So when she was living with Randy, she cared for his partner, David Combs, who died of AIDS in 1990. And after that, she became very involved in AIDS activism and she would often be seen at a Catholic church kneeling before the Virgin Mary and praying for David. So her religion remained quite an important part of her life, particularly, I think, in those later years. On July 6, 1992, her body was found floating in the Hudson River. Now, this was initially ruled as a suicide. But this didn't sit right with those who knew Marsha. Mm. She was so vivacious, she was so full of life, and she was also someone who was often the victim of violent transphobic attacks. Mm. And so many believed that she was murdered. She'd also had been seen trying to escape from some men who were known to harass queer people and trans women and drag queens. And so this suicide just did not sit well with anyone. It was later revised to an accidental drowning, but that was still really not,
yeah,
like not really
what
cool.
Does that say? Nothing.
And so people took to the streets and they marched and they protested and they demanded that the police investigate properly, because it did feel like something that was sort of swept under the rug a little bit, which that's that's a whole thing, right? With trans women, particularly trans women of colour, the murder rates, firstly, are so extremely high, so incredibly disproportionately high.
Mm.
And the sentencing that occurs for the perpetrators of the murders of trans women of colour are abhorrently
disproportionately short.
Yeah, that's right. And if you watch the Netflix documentary, which follows trans activist Victoria Cruz from the Anti-Violence Project in New York as she investigates Marsha's death, she also tells the story of some of these cases and draws attention to the injustice that occurs in the wake of the deaths of trans women of colour, to the bureaucratic difficulties that face those who are trying to advocate and get justice for trans women. And that's really, I think, where if we're allies, like, we need to be putting our money where our mouths are, you know what I mean? Like, this is an area where there is still so much injustice. And I feel, I mean, yeah, I think this is something that I've only really been kind of, I guess, thinking about a lot more recently, and in the ways that I feel like I'm so outside of this and have been quite ignorant perhaps, and I really want to engage more and learn more and understand more and perhaps do more if we, you know, whatever we can to do more, because it's the area where we fucking fall short. Mm. Like, we fall short here and it's not okay. And Marsha is an example of that. And they did reopen her case in 2012 though, so it took years for her case to be reopened.
2012. And what's been found out since then?
Not really anything.
Holy fuck.
No. So there haven't really been very, you know, nothing has particularly has been found. They've investigated some of those leads in terms of those men who people claim had been following her earlier in the day. Victoria Cruz has, you know, been talking to the people who saw her last and trying to track her last movements. And I think the general consensus seems to be that it probably wasn't a direct murder. It may have been a drowning caused by her fleeing people, which still technically is murder.
Yeah, it's more than just an accidental drowning.
Yeah, it's more than accidental drowning. But because there's no, the autopsy reports show that there are not physical signs on her, like, she died in the water.
She died,
basically.
Yeah, she drowned.
She drowned. Yeah, there wasn't any other physical signs that she had been assaulted or anything
but
prior to
her death.
But it's
how she got in that water.
Exactly. Mm. We don't know how she got in the water. And Sylvia is adamant that she never would have committed suicide, because they basically, they had a pact to, quote, go to the River Jordan together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the River Jordan was the Hudson.
Yeah.
And so they, if it came to that, they were going to do it together.
Together.
And so Sylvia's like, nah, she would not have done that without me. And I think also probably without even telling her. And I mean, if it had been suicide, like, she didn't
leave anything behind.
So
it's quite, not that dying is particularly poetic, although we like to romanticise it a lot, but it is, you know, talking as you were before about the way that she would throw offerings into the river, it is actually quite a poetic way to go in the river itself.
Well, this
isn't
is what
it?
I meant at the top of the show when I said the Hudson actually played quite an important role in her life. They lived near the Hudson. Sylvia Rivera moved to an abandoned pier. She lived in basically a shack, a shanty, in an abandoned pier on the Hudson, very close to where Marsha was found. And she struggled quite a lot in the years following Marsha's death. And it took her a while to get back on her feet again. And Sylvia herself died much too young, I think at just 52.
And what, so what year was that?
She passed in 2002 of liver failure. So, but she did become involved again in things like the street transgender action revolutionaries later in life. But yeah, she kind of never really recovered from Marsha's death.
Mm.
It was quite devastating to her. Mm. But if we're going to bring it up into a lighter note to end the show.
Do you have a lighter note to end the show?
I do have a lighter note.
Don't know where we go after that.
And this is that it was announced in May 30 that Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera are getting statues in Greenwich Village, just a block away from Stonewall, and they will be the first transgender folk to have statues in the entire United States.
That's awesome.
Yes, it is.
That's fantastic.
And she has quite a powerful legacy. The New York Times recently included her in their Overlooked Obituaries, which looks at the lives of those who were left out of historical obits.
Well, I was going to say, it seems like, you know, you've mentioned that there's a recent documentary on Netflix. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, how recent is that documentary?
The documentary is quite recent.
Yeah.
It's a couple of years old.
So it seems like, again, this revisionist history project that's happening at the moment, like, again, it seems like she's another one of these figures that we are pulling back into the present, out of the past, digging up those stories, finally paying honour to these people much too late.
Yeah, 50 years later.
Still the fact that there is some kind of actual recognition and statues, that's cool. I mean, that I quite like that.
Yeah. I mean, think about how many statues of white men there are.
Fuck yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, to get two trans women of colour?
Yeah.
Like, wow. Hopefully the first of many more to come, I'm sure. And one more, and that is that the Marsha P. Johnson Institute continues to protect and defend the rights of black transgender people. They were founded as a response to the murders of black trans women and women of colour. And the connection that that has to exclusion from social justice issues, so race, gender, reproductive rights and gun violence. So they are still continuing this work today.
Yeah.
And I think she is a symbol of, you know, that kind of activism that's so important and so necessary, as we've kind of said quite a few times this episode.
And I think, you know, obviously in this month of Pride, looking back at the strides that have been made, but also looking forward at the strides that are still
to be made.
Still to be made.
Yeah. Exactly. And that is why I chose Marsha this week.
Well, thank you very much, Lauren. I thoroughly, well, I don't know, just enjoyed the word. I don't know if enjoyed is the word, but I feel thoroughly enlightened.
Good.
Let's say that.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so happy Pride, everybody.
And, of course, this episode will be coming out at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So we hope you enjoy the last few days of Pride Month.
Especially June 28th. Like, let's have a party. Of course, there's
a sit-in.
There's a million parties.
Let's have a sit-in.
No.
I want to have a sit-in.
Oh, we can have a sit-in party.
Oh, okay.
All right.
All right. Great. Yay. Sit-in.
This has been a long episode, so we better wrap it up.
It has. We've had a few long slash difficult episodes.
Because there's been some timely issues that we felt very strongly about that we needed to talk about.
We did. But I think, you know, we are going to make a concerted effort to bring back
some lightness,
some lols.
Yeah.
Look, we'll find you someone ridiculous next time around. I swear. Maybe ridiculous isn't the word that I want to use, but we'll find some lightness for the next episode.
That would be good. Let's have an episode where we don't cry.
Yeah. Except if we cry, laugh.
Yeah.
Like, we're laughing so hard we cry.
All right.
Yeah.
Good.
Cool. Excellent.
Good. All right. So until next time, thank you so much for joining us again. Happy Pride, everybody.
Happy Pride. And of course, if you would like to catch up on all of our past episodes, you can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, your podcasting app of choice.
So leave a review and subscribe.
Yes, please.
And tell your friends. And if you love the podcast and you want to support us, you can join our Patreon for as little as $2 a month. That's nothing. That's not even a cup of coffee. That's half a cup of coffee for behind the scenes exclusive content, including mini episodes, blooper reels, some animation that Alicia made.
I like the way you said that. So
I didn't want to take credit for that.
Yeah, that's all right.
Can't pretend.
And of course, if you would like to support us in other ways by wearing some bling, some Deviant Women bling, you can buy yourself a t-shirt or a pin on our Etsy store.
Yep. And so, as always, A very big thank you to Brendan Davies for the sound and to India Hui, who composed our music.
And we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.